saying hey, Soul Sister, on BBC Radio Lancashire. Where it's 12 minutes past nine. It's your Lancashire with Gary through till 10 o'clock. And we've been hearing from members of Alcoholics Anonymous about their journey. I hate the journey word, but it is a journey. It's a journey through recovery. And, you know, the damage that alcohol can do to people is remarkable. And I said this as a drinker. I drink, but I can control my drinking. I know when I've had enough. I know when I'm able to, you know, when I'm able to stop, when I've had enough. And that's fine. But some people don't have that relationship. It's a destructive thing. And that's tricky because in society, we mark everything with drink. We celebrate, we have a drink. We commiserate, we have a drink. And it's part of our natural culture, our national culture, I suppose. And that must give people a lot of excuses to carry on harming themselves. But some people are able to get out of that, get on the right path. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a brilliant way to do it. If you have heard anything tonight that's made you think, I wondered about my drinking, or you're just curious about what Alcoholics Anonymous is about, have a look on the website. It's alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk. That's alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk. And if you want to talk to somebody, the number, it's a free number, it's 0800, it's 917-7650. That's 0800-917-7650. We've met four interesting people and we've got two fresh victims to bring to your attention, for fresh meat, if you will. Let's meet Nigel. How are you, Nigel?
Very, very good, thank you.
Good. It's good to talk to you. Good. Thank you for being here, because we appreciate people coming in. Yeah, you're spreading the message, but you know, we wouldn't have a show without people like yourself and our next guest, Julian, and Daniel, who, again, I should thank for putting this together. We'll be hearing from Daniel before we finish this kind of meeting of the airwaves, if you will. So, Nigel, what about, I'm asking people about their first drink. I mean, cast your mind back, and do you remember how you got involved with alcohol?
Yeah. I can remember kind of 10 years old, eggnog at Christmas, which was very, very minor, but really from the age of about 14, friends of mine, we used to hold house parties in our parents' houses.
Oh, okay.
And inviting girls round. The intention was to cop off, but I always got drunk.
So you weren't particularly successful with the ladies because you went a bit heavy on the drink. All right, fair enough.
And it just kept on happening.
Right.
It became the way that I behaved.
Okay. So you were drinking. You were less successful with the ladies, very successful at putting the drink away. And as you went through your teens and your 20s, did you compare yourself to other people? Did you realise you had an issue, or did you just get on with it and drink?
I just got on with it. 18, I got a job analysing sewage, you know.
Okay.
But I was able to train as and to become a professional person. But the fact is that in particular there, at the time when I was doing it, there was a culture of lunchtime drinking.
Right.
And my days just used to be consumed with it.
Okay.
Holding down a job just about. But it was the focus of my life.
So drink was massively important to you. And you were holding down the job, as you said, just about. Does that mean there were sometimes hangovers, sometimes were there sick days? Did you ever find that you couldn't go into work or...?
Yeah, there were lots of occasions like that.
Okay.
And alcohol didn't necessarily cost me a lot. It did, but what it did at that young age, it removed a couple of really great opportunities to progress. I'd gone from working there with the chance of doing a higher degree. But unfortunately, I spent all the time in the pub with my boss,
right.
which doesn't do well for learning.
No.
And I achieved nothing.
So you had a lovely opportunity there to better yourself and to, who knows what you could have gone on to do, but you sort of That went by the by.
Yeah.
Let's bring in Julian. Let's bring in our sixth guest. That sort of chiming with you, that sort of thing, Julian. When would you have had your first drink?
Yeah, very much so. But in relation to the first drink, I can't remember exactly, but funnily enough, we were just talking outside before, and I do remember as a toddler, I used to feign croup because we used to get treated with grape water. And it was only when I was a couple of years sober in AA, I heard someone sharing about it, and I went and Googled it
yeah.
and realised that back in the 70s, it used to be about 3.5-4%. And my mum was
Did
always...
Did you really?
In, yeah. My mum was always in my bedroom with a kettle, you know, and I used to feign it because I hated any other medicines.
Right.
But I remember feigning it, and I broke it when I got to AA. I thought, oh, my Lord. So I realised, actually, there was something there that always made me want that.
I didn't know that Grant Walter was alcoholic. Nurse Woodward's, I seem to remember.
Yeah, in the
Nurse
70s,
Woodward's
yeah,
Grant
I
Walter.
Googled it a few years ago. Because it's not anymore,
My brother was born in 1978, and so early 80s, we'd have had that knocking around the house, you know. But, well, you've taught me somewhat there, Julian. So, you know, again, you're in your teens, you know what I mean? You're growing up. And what about your relationship with alcohol?
Yeah, very similar to, you know, to Nigel. I think in many ways it was one of those. I actually saw it as a badge of honour. I thought, I'm good at this. I knew I wasn't going to be the best footballer or the cleverest person in the class. But by God, I was quite good at drinking. You know, my mates would have 3 or 4 cans and I could have 5 or 6. And that was it was a badge of honour, and I was quite proud of that. And early on in life, it was, Julian can handle his drink and that, and oh, yeah. And then
that's a very male thing, is that, isn't it? It's this male pride in, he put 10 pints away, brilliant, party animal. And it is this sort of badge of honour, as you say. It's like, yeah, a proper man, he can handle his beer. Sort of, they call it now toxic masculinity.
Absolutely.
You know, and we're starting to realise that actually it's behaving like a clown rather than, you know, stomping around saying I can drink my own weight in vodka or whatever it might be. So when did you start getting a sense that you might have an issue?
It wasn't then. I looked at anything that went wrong in my life was always related to drink. There were incidents that, you know, cost me my driving licence. There were incidents that cost me jobs. There were incidents that cost me my 2 front teeth. And every time drink was involved, anything that went wrong, drink was always involved. But it actually wasn't until I was at my birthday party. It was my 30th birthday party. And the moment I first realised that maybe I had an issue was there was about 200 people at this birthday party. It was great. It was a lovely night. It was actually, I felt really good. And it was one of those relatives that you rarely see. And she came up to me and she said, we just had our second son, was married, great job, nice house, everything. And she said, aren't you doing well?
Yeah.
And when she said it, I felt absolutely and utterly shallow and empty inside because I felt like a fraud, because inside I was dying. And yet what hit me at that moment was that everyone's perception of me was that I was doing well. And there was a hollowness inside of me that thought, if only you knew. And yet I wasn't really doing anything other. It was that emptiness inside me that felt that it was just all a front.
To all intents and purposes, anybody looking in, you got a great house, you're married, you got kids on the way, you got a good job, everything's rocking and rolling, there's no problem.
Yeah.
Good old Julian, no problem at all. What about yourself, Nigel? When did you realise that I've got a problem here, I've got an issue?
I probably noticed it from the age of 8, probably about 17, 18. I had something happened on the morning after my 18th birthday. I woke up in bed the following morning surrounded by vomit, and that's pretty frightening, but it didn't deter me. And as I said, as I went on, I was to lose or to give away more and more opportunities. But I always thought I could control it. I thought I was pretty bright. I thought I thought I'd be able to actually deal with it. And obviously I couldn't.
There's a common theme coming up tonight about denial, about people who, I'm on top of this, all I need to do, oh, I'm not as bad as him, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm not drunk, I'm not on a park bench, I'm, you know, I'm holding down a job, I'm fine, whatever it might be. And that is a real monkey on people's back, isn't it? This denial, this, you know, I'm not as bad as him, so I must be, or I wouldn't want to be him, but I'm all right. And there is that sense, isn't there?
I think, yes, one of my, how I think about things, I have two things, fear of failure and fear of what other people think. And so to admit I had a problem would have been a failure.
Yeah.
So I carried on with the charade.
Yeah, putting on the convincing yourself that I'm grand. I just like a drink, whatever, you know? Yeah. So when did you realise that the charade has to stop?
I have another addiction that I'm not going to talk about here.
That's fine.
But it was sober alcoholics in that fellowship who got me to consider whether I might have a problem with my drinking, because my drinking had continued while I was a member of Gamblers Anonymous.
Right.
And people, they just got me to consider it. And I came to realise, once I started, I couldn't stop. All through my drinking, one was too many and a gallon was never enough.
Yeah.
I never turned out unless I was going to get drunk.
So that's the mission when you go out. It's not to have a drink with your mate. It's I'm going to get drunk.
Yeah.
And that's incredible. You know, that people have that in them, if you like. You know what I mean? Because from the point of view of a hopefully, you know, reasonable person who will have a glass of wine and then think, yeah, you know, whatever. I'm constantly making choices. I don't set out to say I'm going to get leathered. We'll have a drink. I'm glad I have that choice. Well, much more to come from Nigel and from Julian between now and 10 o'clock. We're going to take a piece of music to let that percolate in, and then we'll find out how the lads found recovery and, you know, their route, that journey. That word I don't like, but it is a genuine journey for some people. This is Ed Sheeran's latest. It's Overpass Graffiti. It's 25 past nine. It's your Lancashire. That's Ed Sheeran on BBC Radio Lancashire, where it's approaching 9:30, and we're in the company of members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who are telling their stories, telling us their truth about their drinking when it became a problem, and what they did about it. And Julian, we left you pondering, we left you at that fork in the road that we talk about, where you know you knew that everything that had happened to you in your life bad had drink involved, and then that moment went to the outside world that you the boy you had everything, you got the lovely house, you got the wife, you got the kids, it's all great, but you were hollow inside. So what did you do?
Yeah, it's a good question. It was a realization of myself, but to be honest, you know, it took me 10 years from that moment to get to AA. My now ex-wife, she went to an Al-Anon meeting and came back with some literature. She didn't tell me where it was from, which I read. And on the back of that, I thought, actually, this could be me. But I went to my doctors. I went to my doctors and I was put in touch with an alcohol nurse who gave me a little diary to cut down on my drinking. And that set off a cycle, basically, of 10 years of abject misery, really, for ups, downs, and everywhere in between, because that was me trying to control my drinking. And now understand, it was only when I got to the rooms of AA 10 years pretty much to the day later that I realised that I'm an alcoholic and I can never control my drinking.
So that attempt was never going to work because you didn't have that ability to control it. Otherwise, no. It would have been fine and you'd have controlled it and that would have been that.
What differentiates me between 90% of people out there is, as an alcoholic, the first drink sets off a compulsion in me. And it's called the phenomenon of craving. And fundamentally, if I take... And it made sense to me when I got to A, someone explained to me about the first drink and my head was thinking, no, it's OK, I can have five or six some nights. But then other nights, it would just go off. But then when I actually played it back to myself, I realised that if I went to the pub and I was driving, and if I had a pint of bitter shandy, so just a little bit of alcohol in that, because I didn't want to break the laws, I didn't want to drink drive.
Yeah.
If I had a pint of bitter shandy in the first half, I would want my team to lose rather than it going to extra time, because I wanted to get home and have a drink.
Right.
But if I'd had a pint of lime and soda or a pint of Coke or whatever it was, soft drink, no alcohol at all, that effect wasn't on me. The worst pain I've ever had as an alcoholic is to have a drink and not then be able to get another drink.
It's not remarkable that the shandy, people think, I mean, people make jokes about a shandy drinker and all the rest of it, but that it can have that power, that ability to trigger that craving, that's remarkable.
It's an allergic reaction.
Yeah.
It's described, you know, in effectively in those terms. It's an allergy. Effectively, we don't come out in spots, but we have a different reaction to it than 90% of people out there. And one question that you know, that a lot of people will say to you when you go into the rooms of AA is, you know, if you have you ever had a pint or a couple of pints and then thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a cup of tea? And I've never yet met anyone in the rooms that said yes.
Right. So once you're on it, you're on it. And
absolutely.
That's that.
And they were the exact words that a friend of mine said, which made me consider and open my mind up to go to AA.
So you went to AA, you found yourself in the room. What was that first meeting like? As I said earlier on, it's quite a step to walk into that room, to open that door, because you're having to admit to yourself that, yeah, I need help. And that's difficult for people to do. None of us like admitting, do we, that we've got a flaw.
Absolutely right, Gary, and it's the most important step to make, is that asking for help and reaching out. For me, it was my mirror that brought me to that first meeting. Like I said, I'd had 10 years of abject misery. I'd had 10 years of trying to fix it my way and trying to do it with the way suggested. You know, I'd gone through, you know, the local drugs and alcohol team and so on, as they were called, and I've been signed off 8 times as being a model pupil. Everything's back on track. I've got a new job, back on, you know, you're not drinking during the week, and yet the drops always got worse. The difference was that time I looked in the mirror, I realised that I'm all out of answers. I was all out of my own way of trying to fix things. So I thought, I went to that meeting, and the first meeting, for the first 20 minutes, I was convinced that my friend had set all these people up and he'd told them everything that I'd been doing. And then it dawned on me, actually, no, you're not that important, and these people are talking about themselves.
Yeah.
And something just lit in me and thought, actually, that means that if these people are talking about themselves, I am not on my own, because I always felt that nobody, absolutely nobody out there would understand me.
Alison mentioned that as well, that she said, it were like they all knew me, and what they were talking like someone had prepped them up to talk about, you know, yeah. to talk about it. So that obviously you're part of the gang then, you know, that there are people like you and people getting better like you, and that's got to put a spring in your step, I imagine.
I was annoyed at first, to be honest.
Really?
I was annoyed because they had all brightness in their eyes. They were laughing. Because at the time when I got to my first AA meeting, I was so riddled with fear. I was so ashamed. I was so angry inside, you know, and I felt so utterly hopeless and powerless that the hope was more overpowering than the annoyance. But people being around you and laughing and being comfortable with themselves was painful.
Yeah.
But these, as I say, I can't describe it, but the hope that they gave me, because they actually then came over and said, look, if I can do it, you can do it. There's nothing special about me.
Yeah.
We just do this one day at a time. It's a simple program. I'll come and pick you up tomorrow. We'll go to another meeting. And they told me, they said, we'll love you until you learn to love yourself. And that's exactly what they did. And, you know, if I were to describe AA in one word, it'd be love and service. People offer an unconditional love and support to you, not wanting anything back from you other than you to get well.
How long since you've had a drink?
Over 9 years now. It was
remarkable.
15th of August 2012.
Yeah, this is
can't tell you the exact time.
Not like you can. Well, funny you mentioned that. There's one man who can, because I asked him off air, is Nigel, and you know exactly when your last drink was, don't you, Nigel?
I do, yeah. It was 1st November 1987. Quarter past one in the afternoon.
Okay.
In the Royal Marine Hotel in Dunleary.
Don't suppose you know which stool you were sat on, dear? Is that too much?
No.
That's remarkable. 34 years. 34 years sobriety, one day at a time, must be something that makes you happy, and you've got to find pride in that.
It's really good. I've survived.
Yeah.
There's a phrase that I've used in the past, you know, in these rooms we can survive and then we can prosper.
Yeah.
And we're talking in the break, you know, everybody is the same, they are different distances away from their last drink. And the same distance away from the next one.
Yeah, that is a, for want of a better word, a sobering thought. That is a leveller, isn't it? That no matter your journey of 34 years, your journey of 9 years, your journey of 3 days, it's the next drink that's the most important, isn't it? Because that's the one that had put an end to all that good work. So what about you going to, you mentioned that you're in a different fellowship and it was suggested, why don't you give Alcoholics Anonymous a go?
Yeah.
And you did.
Yeah.
And it worked. Tell us about that.
It did. I started initially going to open meetings, but over a period of a few months, I came to realise that I was powerless over alcohol. I couldn't stop when I wanted to. Mm. I didn't get involved seriously with the constabulary, but it could quite easily have happened. And you've heard people earlier on this evening talking about that. I was very, very fortunate.
And was that more luck than judgment, would you say?
I don't think there was any judgment, okay. other than bad judgment involved. I got away with a lot.
So you found sobriety, you've worked at it. What's the change been like in your life?
Quite slow, sustained. It's the single most significant thing I've done in my life.
Mm.
One of my traits is never being able to sustain things for any extended period of time. But over the time that I've been sober, I've been in a position, because of my circumstances, to get to regular meetings on a weekly basis. Goodness knows how many cups of tea I've drunk. Goodness knows how many cups of tea I've made.
Yeah, well.
Meetings I've been to. But I've made friends within the fellowship over decades who are unique and priceless.
It's remarkable.
It is unique and priceless. It's actually in part of our literature, and it's proved to be true. In fact, our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, was written in 1938 and published in 1939, and the pertinent part of it, the first 11 chapters apart from the stories, they haven't been changed. And they're as pertinent to today as they were when it was written.
It's incredible, isn't it? That then again, if a system isn't broken, you don't want to fix it. If it works, it works, and clearly it does for a lot of people, you know. As people have said, it might not be for everybody, but it works for an awful lot of people if they're prepared to put that work in and to be fearless and to want to help themselves. You know, that's the important thing. We've asked about music, and I'm always interested when people choose an Elvis song. And Julian, you've chosen an Elvis song for us tonight, If I Can Dream. Do you want to tell us why you've chosen that song in particular?
Yeah, thanks, Gary. I used to play this song over and over and over and over again.
Right.
And I would be sat in my flat in a state of, why can't I change? Why? There must be something out there. And it was only actually not that long back in sobriety that I listened to it again. And the searching, I used to feel that searching that he was looking for in that song. And I get everything that he's looking for, and everything that I was looking for, sat there in my state of unhappiness, of hopelessness, I've got now through AA.
And it really is as simple as that. You found what you needed.
I get everything I look for in drink through what I do, through the 12 steps of AA.
It's incredible. It's a classic song. We're going to play it now. We're going to play. And with that in mind, listen to what Julian said. Just have a listen to the words. You might see this song in a different light than you've heard it when you've listened to it before. It's Elvis Presley and If I Can Dream.
In a sky more blue, if I can dream of a better land where all my brothers walk hand in hand, tell me why. understanding sometime. Strong winds of promise that will blow away the doubt and fear. If I can dream of a warmer sun where hope keeps shining on everyone, tell me why, oh why, oh why won't that sun appear? We're lost in a cloud with too much rain. We're trapped in a world that's troubled with pain. But as long as a man has the strength to dream, he can redeem his soul and fly. Deep in my heart, there's a trembling question. Sure that the answer's gonna come somehow out there in the dark. There's a beckoning candle, yeah. And while I can think, while I can talk, while I can stand, while I can walk, while I can dream, oh please let my dream.
That's a big finish. That's Elvis Presley, If I Can Dream, on BBC Radio Lancashire, the choice of Julian, one of our guests from Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a caller. Paul has called in from Chorley, and he's on the line. Paul, you've been listening to the show tonight. What have you made of what you've heard?
Well, I've listened to bits of it. I must admit, not listened to all of it yet. I will listen back on BBC Sounds. It's a subject that's quite important to me, and I've got to admire those people who have had the strength to get away from alcoholism. Unfortunately, my sister, I lost her 10 years ago to drink. She hasn't got the strength to face her battles, face her demons, and although she loved the family very, very much, she just didn't have that strength to overcome what had become an addiction to her. And it's an illness, and I do recognise that. So for those that have got over it and found peace and found a future, I applaud you.
Paul, when you say you lost her, are we talking about losing her permanently?
Yes, yeah. She died of cirrhosis of the liver. She had a number of things going on in her life. I think the biggest thing, I mean, she did get married to a much older man, and he promised her that they could have children. And not long after the wedding, he said, "Look, I don't want children after all. I've got two daughters, and we've got a younger brother, and he's got three children now." But I think she thought in the natural order of things, she should have had a child next. And I think she never got over that. And she'd have made a brilliant mum. And, you know, she didn't have that strength. And, you know, she went in a downward spiral and found peace in the bottle, unfortunately.
It must be really difficult, Paul, when you love somebody and you can see the damage that they're doing to themselves. But as we've heard tonight and on previous occasions, the person who's doing the drinking, you could tell them a million times and they wouldn't want to listen to you, they wouldn't take it on. And that must really hurt to be that person watching somebody slipping away.
It's horrible, Gary. You know, it's just, you know, I felt awful about it now. I felt anger towards her. I felt resentment at the time because I could see what she's doing to herself. but at the same time battling my own conscience, because I knew that she'd got an illness and she couldn't get away from that. You know, she was given counselling, but she didn't go. She started living with another man who was an alcoholic himself, and obviously he wasn't the best person to try and get her away from the drink. In fact, she came out of hospital not the last occasion and was told that you cannot touch alcohol again, you cannot do it because it will kill you. And she got home and he went to the off-licence and bought a couple of bottles of wine to celebrate the fact she came out of hospital. So it's ironic. You know, it's hard, but you know, it's good in a way because I can talk to people and try and educate them. But you know, people who call Paul Gascoigne, George Best, waste of space, and you see it on social media. You know, he's had a liver. What's he doing drinking again? Well, it's an illness. It's an illness, and until people have lived with somebody who goes through that, they'll never understand it's an illness. It's not a choice necessarily.
No, this is a, people wouldn't choose to damage the soul, would they? It's no. As we've learned tonight and on previous occasions, it's more than, well, just don't have a drink, you know. And as you say, when your sister came out of hospital, being told if you have a drink, it'll likely kill you, going to off license tells you all you need to know. Well, I'm sorry for your trouble, Paul. I'm sorry that your sister couldn't find something like Alcoholics Anonymous and couldn't, you know, find the support and strength to, you know, to deal with the demons. And, you know, it sounds like you're a good family, good strong family, and I'm sure you're all there for her. You know, sometimes you can't help people, as hard as you try and as difficult as it is, you can't help people unless they want to help themselves. So
that is the key, that they've got to want to help themselves. And, you know, if she found that little chink of light, then maybe, but I can't live with regrets. You know,
no.
we had a happy life for the 40 years that she lived. And, you know, and she had a reasonably good life up to that point. But, you know, I just commend, like I say, all those people that have found that peace and found the strength to carry on.
Yeah.
Because you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel if you can just about find it. And,
you know, absolutely.
It's important, Gary, that you're talking about it tonight. And, you know, commend you for doing that.
Well, it's not me. I'm just a conduit. It's these guys that have come to be very, very brave and tell the stories and get the message of hope out there. Paul, we wish you well. Thank you so much for listening. I want to bring Andrew in. Andrew's been listening tonight as well. Good evening, Andrew. Tell us your comment.
Good evening, mate. Yeah. I'm Andy Matt, mate. I've just been listening tonight and about everyone talking about the programme and the 12 steps. And, you know, about 8 months ago, I was in intensive care myself. Like, I didn't think I was drinking since like the age of 13, and I didn't think there was any way out, to be honest with you. I didn't know about AA or a 12-step program. Literally, it took me to my knees, to rock bottom, and I've lost everything. I've lost my family, my children, the lot, you know, and I lost myself in the end. And you know, and through this program and doing the 12 steps, it gives you the hope and it gives you the belief and, you know, the courage to actually. And now I wake up in the morning and I'm actually grateful for life today, if you get what I mean.
That's brilliant, man.
If anybody out there is struggling, like, I do suggest that you get in touch and try and get yourself into AA and the 12-step program, because, like people say, it works, you know. And, like, I never did well at school myself, you know, and when I got introduced to the 12 steps, I thought, oh, it's a lot of writing, I'd struggle, but... But no, it's just you do it to the best of your ability, and what you get out of it is, you know, it's absolutely amazing, mate.
Yeah, well, I think you've 6 months under your belt, haven't you?
I've got 6 months under my belt, mate. Yeah, it's something I never thought possible, to be honest with you. It's through this programme I've been able to do that.
Well, Andrew, listen, that's brilliant. We wish you well. We wish you another 6 months and 12 months and 18 months. And who knows, maybe next time we do a special, maybe you'll come on. And maybe you can say, you know, I'm 18 months, I'm 5 years, whatever it might be. So, but that's Andrew calling us in. Nigel, 34 years under your belt. I mean, there would have been a time when you were 6 months sober. And, you know, did you imagine at that point that you'd have 34 years under your belt ever?
I don't think I looked. Don't think I look so far ahead. It's a day at a time. The fact is, I'm a damn sight older than I was when I got here. But it, as I said before, survive and prosper.
Yeah, which is important, isn't it? And listening to Andrew there now, he's a man who lost everything, as he said, lost everything, lost hope, and now he's got hope. He's got 6 months there, 6 months hard won sobriety, you know, and there were optimism in his voice and there were excitement in his voice as well. And, you know, a guy who's hopefully on the right path, and it's the programme. Let's bring Daniel in. We started with Daniel as well. What do you think, listening to those callers, Daniel? I mean, you know, you're immersed in the AA and its existence. You know, what do the calls mean to you?
Certainly, you know, I can identify with Paul because, yet it is an illness. It's a cunning, baffling and powerful illness, you know. Mm. And I've heard countless stories of people coming out of hospital and picking up that drink when they've been told, you know, if you drink again, you're going to die, you know. Yeah. And some are lucky, but the majority aren't, you know. And
see, that's a really stark message. If somebody told me that, I wouldn't go past the pub. Do you know what I mean? I'd be frightened to death.
Yeah, but this is the irony of the illness, unfortunately. You know, you think next time I'll be all right, or I'll just have one, and this is the crux of this illness. It'll tell you many things, but it'll forget all the times, the thousands of times that it caused the problems.
Yeah.
And the obsession is an idea overriding every other idea that next time you're going to be all right, but yet again you get into the ring and it beats you up even harder.
Yeah.
And I'm just glad that I got off the train when I did. And, you know, in reflection to Paul, if there's anyone else out there in the same situation as Paul or a similar situation where you have a family member that you're concerned about, or, you know, if you're suffering yourself as well, you know, if you're concerned about someone, obviously you can tell them about this show tonight. You can get it on BBC Sounds and listen to it again. But also, for those that are suffering, there is Al-Anon that's been mentioned already, where you can go to for help, for friends and family of alcoholics, because, you know, people suffer around the alcoholic. We're like a tornado, you know. So, yeah, it's relate. That's what we do in AA. We relate to stories, but we don't just relate to stories of those people that are suffering in recovery, but to those that have suffered by the alcoholic as well.
Yeah, I'm looking at the three of you, Nigel, and yourself, Daniel, and Julian as well. And I'm looking at almost 60 years of recovery between you lads. I mean, Nigel, you're 34, 16 for yourself, Daniel, 9 for Julian. That's a lifetime for some people, isn't it? That's incredible. And you've done that one day at a time between you. There's a bit of magic about AA, isn't there? The lads are nodding. Everyone's nodding, all in agreement there, yeah, you know. It's clear that what it offers people for nothing, you know, you see all these like self-help books and you see all this wellness and you can buy a course on this and that and the other and pay a fortune for these gurus and what have you. but AA is free. AA doesn't cost a penny, and it's open to everybody. What is it like to be part of that, Nigel?
Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic.
And to be able to help people, offer your hope to other
Newcomers
people.
Newcomers are our lifeblood. The primary purpose of an Alcoholics Anonymous group is to be available to carry the message of AA to the alcoholic who still suffers.
Yeah.
Newcomers are vital.
Well, that's what we've done tonight. You had a wonderful track chosen, and with less than 3 minutes away from the 10 o'clock news, with respect, will you forgive me if we don't play your track? It's Pink Floyd track, 7.5 minutes and so on. I've played everybody's song, and I feel really mean now, you know, saying that we're not going to play it. It's just that we'll get not so far at 10 o'clock, and I just wanted to wrap up with Daniel and with Julian. So thank you so much for that. Thank you for letting us do that. It's very generous of you. Daniel, how does the meeting end? There's like when you've got a form of words, haven't you, at the end of a meeting?
We have the serenity prayer that we usually say at the end of the meeting. We also have a responsibility pledge that's said at some meetings, but at the vast majority of meetings, we say the Serenity Prayer.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you'd like us to do that collectively,
love you to do that, please. If you would, that'd be terrific.
We can.
Yeah. Let's go for it.
Yeah. So, if we use the word God as we do, I do not understand in God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
And effectively, that is about accepting the things around me that I can't change and having the courage to change myself and the wisdom to know the difference between the two of the things that I can change in myself and the things around me that I can't. So
that's a powerful message as well. Reactions still coming in. Andy Wilcox says, AA changed his life. And we've got to say, will you congratulate Dulce? They've been 3 years clean through Alcoholics Anonymous, which I think is remarkable, isn't it? It's clear that this magic, as when I said magic, you nodded emphatically, Julian, that this magic saves people's lives if they want to do it, if they're at that point where they're ready to accept it. Got to give you the numbers, got to give you the website again as the 10 o'clock news approaches rapidly. It's coming down the track, said us. John Gilmore after that as well. I could have done with borrowing an hour off Gilly, but never mind, I'll let him on at 10. It's alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk. That's alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk. That's helpline number is a free number, well worth a call. 0800 917 7650. That's alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk and 0800 917 7650. I hope you found this programme as remarkable and inspiring as I have. John Gilmore's next. It's news.